Division. On this slide, you'll see the mission statement for the division. This gives us the ground rules, if you will, for enforcing the International Building Code, the City Code, any PUD agreements, any zoning ordinance, or those zoning ordinance, handicap accessibility code, property maintenance code, so that we can ensure that people in our community will live, work. Pardon me.
Excuse me.
Oh, there you go. I'm sorry. I don't know. There we go. Back to the mission statement. So that we can ensure that the citizens of the city and our visitors to the community live, work, shop in a very safe built environment. We've broken down in our responsibilities of the division into six categories: construction, maintenance, zoning board of appeals, signs, historic preservation, and public education. Construction. We deal with permits from application to occupancy. We perform plan reviews, we issue the permits, and we do the required inspections. Oops. Sorry, I'm one ahead. I'm not real good at this. Property maintenance. We employ a systematic code compliance monitoring of field violations. We issue citations for those violations that we find. And then we also do what's compliance planning, where we get with the citizen, property owner, and try to work out a compliance plan. They'll get it done in 3 months or 4 months, whatever, as long as we know what their plan is and they're working towards that. Those steps don't work, then we go to a local adjudication and or the circuit court system. And we'll get into more of that as we go along. We staff the Zoning Board of Appeals. We act as a secretary to the board. We also assist the customers as they're making application to the Zoning Board. They have a lot of documents that they have to gather and put together, assemble into a packet. Then we take that packet and send them to the zoning board members and people within 250 feet. So there's a lot of steps that they have to go through in order to get that accomplished. They have to address the four standards for variation, reasonable return, unique hardship, character of the area, and minimum variation needed. We also administer the sign code, any PUD agreements out on Randall Road that have signs, sign ordinances that relate to that area, and any sign code amendments that we may feel are necessary that we'll bring to the City Council and committees as a whole for review and or approval. Permits for work in the Historic Preservation District. We work with the city planner on signs and any improvements that happen to occur in that district. Here's two slides. The one in the upper left-hand corner, 327 North 2nd Street, that building has been moved now to face on 124 Stevens Street. It's been totally rebuilt and looks very nice. And then in the right-hand corner is a sign package for the Pass Basket building. Those are both items that were reviewed and approved through historic preservation and through our division. Education. We produce and disseminate packets for various types of improvements like decks, sheds, pools, patios, hot tubs, sidewalks, driveways. And those packets are available in our office. They're also available online at our website. Excuse me. Each year we bring to Mayor and City Council the ordinance to proclaim National Building Safety Week in May. and we also produce the monthly reports that come to the council on our activities. Excuse me. When are permits required is a question we get all the time. Do I need a permit for this type of improvement or this type of project? Here you'll see a list of 17 projects that require permits. One might ask, and I get this question a lot, why do you need a permit for a water heater replacement? If that's a gas water heater, we want to make sure that it's vented properly, it has a valve on the gas line, and that the discharge for the relief valve is in the proper location so that if in fact does go off when someone's downstairs, they're not going to get scalded by that hot water that comes out of the water heater. If it's an electric heater, we want to make sure that the overcurrent protection device in the panel, the circuit breaker or fuse, is sized properly for the amperage and wattage of the water heater, and again, the relief valve. So that's just one example of why we need permits to do the things we do, and if anyone ever has a question as to why we do it, please feel free to stop by the office or give me a jingle on the phone and be more than glad to share with you why we issue permits for various types of projects. Excuse me. Adopted codes and amendments. 1995, we did the first multi-jurisdictional adoption of the building code in the Valley, Geneva, St. Charles, Batavia, Elburn, and North Aurora. We took the 1995 1 and 2 Family Dwelling Code, basically went page by page and created amendments to that code, uniform up and down the Valley, so that builders, homeowners, whatever, no matter where they're working, they'll know what the rules are, and they're consistent up and down the river. But these are the codes that we've adopted to date. We're in the process of beginning a review for the 2009 International Residential Code. Permit process begins with the application, the routings of the plans to the various city departments. If it's a new commercial building, that plan set gets routed to the fire department, the building department, engineering, electrical, Community Development Department, Planning Division. So those all get routed to the various different departments from our division. Once all those reviews are completed, they come back to us. We issue the permit. And in most cases, that'll take, unless it's a PUD and they're working through that process, but the permit process will take 2 weeks or less. Permits issued at the counter. We can issue permits at the counter for things such as siding, roofing, water heaters, furnaces, air conditioners, driveways, unless the driveway is involving the apron, then we need a right-of-way permit. That takes a little bit, another step. Excuse me. Lifespan of a permit. At this question a lot is how long is my permit good for? The permit's good for a year from the date they pick the permit up. If nothing happens in that year, the permit becomes null and void. If the project starts and it stops for any reason, it has 6 months, a life of 6 months at that point. If nothing happens on that in 6 months, then the project's dead and they have to start all over again. Excuse me. And the various inspections that we do. Here's a copy of the application that we use, an application for permit. When I started in 1986, we had three applications for permits, building permits, sign permit, and fence permits. We've now just gotten that down to one permit and one page. It's easier for the customer and less paper for us. Copy of the weather card. This goes with permits that have been issued. Up in the top here, we'll have the permit number, date it's issued, location, We'll circle the various different inspections that they need to have performed. We'll route them to the bottom of the card where you see the phone number, and then a 24-hour notice. Most communities are 48 to 72 hours. We try to keep it at 24. Inspections. On the left, you'll see the inspections that are typically performed on a single-family home. On a commercial project, it'll have just more of the same, more footings, more backfills. May do framing electrical in three or four stages for some electrical or for some commercial projects. But that's for a single-family home. All inspections are tracked in the computer, and they become a permanent record, so that when a homeowner comes to us and says, hey, you know, my stoop was never inspected, and it's starting to crack. We can go back into the computer and say, well, yeah, on June 6th of 1997, it was, in fact, inspected, and it was approved. And then we issue certificates of occupancy, either temporary certificates or final certificates. Final certificates state they meet the minimum standards as established by city code. We'll show you a copy of that in a second. The worksheet that the inspectors use is an inspection checklist at the bottom. This is really important when we get into the subdivisions where we're doing three and four final inspections a day, or yeah, at a time. Inspectors tend, when they do that, tend to look at the same things in every single home the same way. So what I've tried to do is say, okay, now you take this, and it'll make you look a little wider, broader scope when you're doing the inspection, so you don't get into that routine. Inspection notice, inspection tag, we put the date, the address, lot number, type of inspection, work's been approved, has not been approved, and there's a reinspection fee required, or there may not be. We use a reinspection fee when there's contractors that, you know, have done 10 decks in town and they know what the rules are. They're supposed to be 10-inch diameter piers by 42 inches deep, and every single time we go out there, they're 8 inches in diameter and they're 36 inches deep. Bingo, he's going to get charged $75. Eventually, he's going to learn, he or she is going to learn, that do it right doesn't cost him anything. We put comments in this section and then sign it and indicate whether you're with the building department or fire department. Certificate of occupancy. Certificate number is the building permit number. The issued date is what it is. Up at the top, where we put in, is, could be a single-family home located at 227 McKinley Avenue. This states that the structure that they're going to occupy meets the minimum standards necessary for occupancy as found in the city code. Now, code enforcement. We use a systematic approach using the wards as areas that we target. We don't do them in any specific order. It's not like, you know, fifth ward is Monday, fourth ward is Tuesday. We'll shake it up so that it's not in any specific order. We identify the violations. We attempt to develop a compliance plan with the property owners. Again, either bringing them into the office or speaking on the phone, explaining that, you know, we have these violations and I didn't do that. What are we going to do to solve the problems and give us a time frame and how you want to, you know, accomplish that and how long it'll take? We've gone out as far as a year in some cases to, as long as they're not life safety items. You know, as long as they have they're working towards compliance. Otherwise, we issue citations, we hold the adjudication hearings, and this last one is kind of really doesn't belong there, but I want to mention it. We're tracking foreclosures right now. We get from the county a list of foreclosures every week that occur in Geneva. I'm sending that to some people so that they're able to track them as well, fire and police and what have you. But then we go out and do a drive-by. All the guys are instructed to drive by those foreclosures every so often, whether it be every couple days or every week, just to keep a track of them so that the grass isn't getting a foot long, the windows aren't getting broken out of it, the swimming pool's not, you know, full of water and becoming an attractive nuisance, things like that. Here's just two examples of some code enforcement issues that we've had. I got junk cars. This one tried a clever way to try to hide it by building a fence around it. And this one is on the lower right. You've got peeling paint, rotten soffit spacers, no downspouts. This is something we started this year.
I just took the words out.
The yellow sign for tall grass. We'll come across them. We'll put the address up on the top line, and down on the bottom, we'll inform them as to what day that grass has to be cut by. If it's not, our contractor will go out and do that and take the sign, bring it back to our office. We have lost a few signs, but it's okay. Then they go out and cut it, and we bill them for it. And if we don't get satisfaction, we don't get paid, then we just either lien the property or go to collection. This is working out pretty well for us. This allows the neighbors and the aldermen to see that we've seen it, we're aware of it, and we're working on it. And I just thought that was kind of a unique way of doing it. Notice of violation. These are sent first class and certified mail. This cites chapter and title and chapter and section of the code, tells them how many days they have to comply, what happens if they don't comply, and what it's going to cost them if they don't comply or if they're found guilty by the hearing officer. This is a copy of the summons. Summons is used if we don't get any compliance. We'll issue the summons. It instructs them on the hearing date, the hearing time, and the hearing location. Down at the bottom, you'll have proof of service so that we know that it's been served. And a decision, certification of findings, decision, and order. The hearing officer fills this out after the hearing's completed with their findings, their decision, and their orders. We started last year in doing joint hearings with Batavia and North Aurora. It's working out very well. It's a cost savings exercise. Instead of paying $300 a month for a hearing officer, now we're only paying $100 a month. So it's working out very well. Plus a third of the recorders, recording secretaries' wages. In 2008, we had 304 contacts. In 2009, already 7 months, we've had 409 contacts. 10% of those contacts go to summonses. And we're having at the moment an 84.4% compliance rate. Special projects and initiatives, wind energy, division office remodeling, energy conservation efforts. We're looking at wind energy. As most people and places and companies are, we're getting phone calls all the time on it. We need to review our zoning ordinance to see how they're addressed in the zoning, as far as zoning is concerned, you know, as far as height, noise, how does it affect birds, things of that nature. The National Electric Code is basically silent at this point on wind energy. I anticipate the 2010 National Electric Code will have a whole section on it, but we'll have to look at that as well. And what happens if they generate more electricity than they use? Do we have to, as a city, do we have to buy that back? There's a lot of things we have to discuss about that. Customer service improvements and security in the building division offices. We're going to open up the wall, our west wall. We're going to move the counter forward so the customers no longer come into the office. They'll stand right out in the vestibule, and they'll access the office through the window. They'll be able to have two customers at a time. The door will come out into this area here where the table is. The swinging doors will be converted to fixed doors, exit only, and they'll be locked during the day. energy conservation for City Hall. We took the last 6 years of our energy usage for electricity and been tracking it. And we put in some, if you'll see, like these light fixtures that are here and those that are downstairs, they were all four bulb fixtures, they're now three bulb with higher efficiency. We put timers, shorter timers on the bathroom lights and fans, put timers on all the outside lights. We've changed, we put cutback thermostats on all the heating and ventilating and air conditioning. And we took out a 40-gallon water heater and replaced it with a 14-gallon water heater. So we're looking at some conservation measures for the electric usage here at City Hall. And this graph will show you that those efforts have already panned out. Some of that might be the fact that we haven't had to run the air conditioning as much this year as we have in years past. But I think it's pretty significant savings there so far. Again, thank you for the opportunity this evening, and I'd like to open it up for any questions or comments that anyone may have.
Well, thank you, Charles Lencioni. It's very, very informative. And are there any questions from the council members, please? Alderman Charles Brown.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Singer. One of the latest things we've added to the inspections and the need for a permit were window replacements. And I've had a couple of questions from people that saying, this is a handyman job replacing a single window, which you replace from inside the house, and it's a pretty simple job, and anybody can go to Home Depot or Home Hardware or any of the major stores, and they will explain to you exactly how you do it. It's a pretty simple job, but why do people need a permit for that?
We need to make sure that they're not, that the opening's not getting any larger. We don't need any larger headers above the window. Without being involved, we really don't know what, you know, what's going to occur. We've made it a minimal fee. I believe that's the minimum fee is $50. You know, we just need to be part of that process so that we can, you know, determine and ascertain whether or not the opening is getting larger or not, if there was not an opening there before.
So it is true that even a single window replacement does require a city permit?
Yes, sir. And we will issue those as they come in the door while they're standing there waiting for us. And we'll do that inspection that day.
Thank you.
We're not going to try to hold them up at all. We're going to try to work with them and get it accomplished.
Well, thank you for explaining that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions from the council? Alderman Marks.
Are the contacts just, they've increased this year tremendously, it looks like, over last year. Is that just based upon the economy, or is it just that?
Yeah, the foreclosures have added some numbers to that. I don't know the exact numbers to that, but
that's what's really driving it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Alderman Flanagan.
Thank you. I just have the list that you provided. Does the new residential, number 17, actually include additions too? Because I didn't know if you didn't put specifically additions.
That's correct. I did not put additions on there. You're correct.
Okay, so is this inclusive?
Yes, that's.
But then additions would be under the new residential.
Right.
Okay. When you're talking about tall grass, I just want to kind of just, if I may, touch upon that.
Sure.
When it's tall grass, but it's not necessarily, or what we could call maybe not tall grass, but tall weeds, if these weeds are close to the home like that picture indicated, that also is something that the city will take care of.
Yes, ma'am.
If it's not taken care of by the foreclosure or the homeowner or whatever.
Correct. We'll go in and have a contractor with a weed eater.
Or whatever, weed whack it or whatever the case may be. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's just restrictive to the lawn.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, not at all.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Alderman Hill.
Chuck, on the question of length of time during construction, what constitutes a continuation of construction if a home had been started and it looks like from the exterior to residents or neighbors that not much is being done? I mean, does it have to show some evidence of continuation of construction, or what's the time frame there?
Technically, if they went out and and painted one room, or you know, put some boards down on the deck. And that's the flaw in the system, is that that six-month clock starts ticking again. We're looking, as a staff and as a profession, we're looking at the possibility of doing something like a letter of credit or a bond. Some of the larger communities do a bond. When they apply for a permit, you put up a $15,000 bond. Now, if they don't work on that project any longer, we would at least be able to go in and clean up the site, finish the exterior, so it looks like it's fairly, clean for the neighborhood, sod it, seed it, whatever, and get it back to looking normal. So we're looking at that up and down the valley.
Yeah, I would encourage that, because if somebody just goes in there and they're in a remodeling project where they have a permit, a legitimate permit, and they paint an interior wall on a room that is not visible, that gives them an extra 6 months, and the house may be falling apart in the meantime. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Alderman Chino.
And on the foreclosures, Chuck, I've had a couple calls. I guess the bank technically owns the property. Is it hard to collect on those or figure out what's going on? Because these neighbors think that the grass is going to get cut every week. And
yeah, it's very difficult. The banks, I can't believe that they would take on the responsibility of an asset and not maintain it. But they're not interested in maintaining it. They don't. But at least from what we're told, they're not interested in maintaining it. So that becomes our issue. We'll have to go in and cut the grass. But it's not going to be done like you would do your own lawn. It'll be done, every couple, 3 weeks. And once it gets to 8 inches, then we'll have it cut.
And the banks are going to be paying for that, or you think they will?
We either lien the property or send it to collection.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm like a hound dog on those. That's
Alderman Brown, please.
Yes, to follow up on the foreclosure, I've heard anecdotally that sometimes the people who are leaving the foreclosed house will take appliances and fixtures and things with them, and that must leave behind a rather unsafe situation in some cases. And one worries exactly if the bank isn't willing to accept the responsibility. There's no way we could legally do it, and there's no way we could legally even find out. But it seems to me that, is it possible that if a neighbor thinks that there's a violation, if they smell gas or...
Call the fire department immediately.
Yeah, or if they see people
and we'll
carrying fixtures out of the place, wonder what's left behind, exposed wires or...
Have them let our department know, and we'll call NICOR and have the gas turned off at the street.
I worry about exposed wire. I mean, people tearing out fixtures and appliances will typically leave behind a unsafe electrical condition.
We've had homes where the pipes have frozen. The water has just run for weeks. So when we run across those, we make sure that the water's turned off at the street and the gas and the electric.
So you inspect them. If you see something by eye, if your people see something that looks suspicious,
let us know.
Do we have any right to do something?
Sure. Yes. We don't have right to go trompsing through the house.
But you would at least contact the parent owner, which may be the bank.
The bank, and we'd take whatever steps we could to secure it from the outside. I'm not opposed to boarding it up if we have to. If there's broken windows, we'll call a board-up company and get it boarded up. And we'll just charge them for it and put a lien on the property.
Thank you.
Alderman Flanagan.
Thank you. I guess it kind of prompted a thought in my head. Isn't there some way that we can notify banks that they have to, or send them a list of things that they have to comply with? Or are we stepping out of our boundaries?
They don't feel they have to. They're not the owner.
Yeah, they are the owner. Temporary owner, at least.
They don't feel they are.
It seems kind of ludicrous, doesn't it?
This comes up in our inspectors and commissioners meetings up and out throughout the state on a monthly basis.
It makes no sense. The bank has to assume some responsibility. They took the property away, got the property. Shouldn't say taken away.
There's some kind of statute that says they don't have any responsibility for that asset.
Then who does?
It's what the problem is.
Well, the next buyer is.
Very nice. Yes, so Administrator McKittrich.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just a couple of things I wanted to mention. There was this last session in Springfield, there was legislation that was proposed that would make the banks responsible for ensuring that the water was turned off and the gas was turned off and the lawns were mowed. Mm-hmm. That did not pass. So I encourage you, again, I will say, elected officials, listen to elected officials, constituents, contact your state representatives. This is an important bill, particularly in this day and age. Yeah. We need this assistance. As a non-home rule community, we do not have the authority to go in and do inspections under these circumstances. So this was one piece of legislation that we were at least hoping would pass so that the banks had to accept responsibility. So I would encourage everyone to help get that passed this next upcoming session. The second thing is I just wanted to ask Chuck if he would mind, with regard to the plan consulting, plan and application review inspections, code enforcement, could you talk about the staffing levels that you have to take care of these responsibilities, just for the benefit of the general public?
Currently, I have a question of Mary on that issue on the bill in Springfield. Would it be possible for you to communicate to us the bill number and what the title of it is?
I will, but it was last session.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know that it would be introduced by the same sponsor under the same bill number, but I can get the one from last year, this last session.
If something would be helpful, otherwise maybe
sure.
Fishing in a dry pond.
I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you.
Good idea.
At the current time, we have the building commissioner, myself, one building inspector. We have a part-time building inspector that went from half-time last year to quarter-time this year. And the code enforcement officer, whose hours have been reduced to 32 hours a week, and the full-time administrative assistant in the division. And that's the staffing levels that we currently have. Look forward to getting those back to full levels when we're...
So you basically have three people, you're
that's
saying?
That's correct.
Are there any other questions from the council members? Any from the audience? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Lencioni.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you again for the opportunity.
All right, let's continue on with item D. Considering the authorization to conduct plan commission public hearings on city-initiated zoning map amendments, which is the east side of North First Street, and R1 low density to R3 medium to high density single family residential districts. And Mr. Hunch is going to speak to this issue.
Yes, thank you, Mayor Pro Tem. I just wanted to introduce this matter. David DeGroot, our city planner, has been doing most of the yeoman work on this project, but I wanted to just say a few things. We're talking about 24 properties here that are located along the east side of First Avenue, Route 31, from North Avenue up to our corporate limit line, our shared corporate limit line with St. Charles. These are properties that all have a direct rear lot line relationship. They abut the river. What we have discovered as we've been working with the public and working with property owners that have been in dialogue with us, we have taken a look at this area, and we have 11 properties that are non-conforming with respect to the current R1 zoning. There are a total of 24 properties in the area. This is a pretty high level of zoning non-conformity that's rather uncommon in our community, actually, in terms of how we have historically zoned property. We're receiving inquiries from individuals that are interested in purchasing property. Property goes on the market, And as we walk through these dialogues with people, they're saying, well, you know, I want to buy this home, and I want to either expand it, go through some major renovations, or I want to demolish the property and put up a new home. Well, what we have to share with them, because of the zoning nonconformity with respect to minimum lot area or minimum lot width, is that if the home were destroyed by a calamity, by a tornado or a fire, and they invested in a rehab of that home, they would not be able to rebuild it under our nonconforming provisions in our zoning ordinance. Secondarily, if someone were to have an interest in purchasing property, purchasing the home, demolishing the house to reinvest and place a new home on that property, they would not be able to do it. So David's done some nice work here in terms of just getting our arms around what's actually going on in this area, and he's here to present some information to you, and he's got a request as well.
Well, thank you, Dick, for that introduction, and thank you all for letting me propose this tonight. I'm just going to pull up a PowerPoint here and kind of go through the summary Dick just gave in a little more detail. Okay, the purpose of this presentation this evening is just to present the proposal and to request authorization to notify the property owners affected by the proposal and to discuss it with them and specifically how it impacts their individual properties, and then to ultimately schedule a Planning Commission public hearing based on their feedback. So we're really just requesting authorization tonight to take that next step. If we get that authorization, the next step would be to immediately mail notification letters to the affected property owners. We do have drafts of those prepared, and we could send those out as soon as tomorrow morning if necessary. We would then discuss the proposal with the owners, offering to meet with them on an individual basis if they would like to. I suspect that would take several weeks to go through with 24 property owners being impacted, so we'd probably be looking at a Planning Commission in October, possibly November. This is the area Dick described. We have 24 properties on the east side of North First Street, directly across from Wheeler Park, starting at North Street and extending all the way up to our corporate limit line. You can see here that some of the properties consist of multiple parcels, but we have a lot of single parcel lots too. Of these 24 properties, we have lots ranging from 6,000 square feet in size to over an acre in size, and with lot frontages ranging from 50 feet to 140 feet. So quite the mix of properties in this area. The existing R1 zoning was established in 95 with the adoption of the zoning ordinance. The intent of the R1 zoning district is to be a low-density, single-family district. And you can see here that we have a minimum lot area of 13,000 square feet and frontage of 100 feet. And then some generous building setbacks, street yard 25, side yard 12 feet, and rear yard of 35 feet. And as Dick mentioned, we've discovered that there are several nonconformities in this target area. Based on our city records, the plats of survey we have on file, our GIS databases, I've been able to identify 30 nonconformities in the area in relation to lot size, frontage, or setbacks. And I've been able to confirm that at least 16 of the 24 properties are impacted by those nonconformities. And based on the large number that we've discovered, it's our conclusion that in 1995 the intent was to encourage house demolition and lot consolidation and have conforming lots under the R1 zoning requirements. It's not uncommon for zoning ordinances to intentionally create nonconformities. It is a little unusual, though, to have this many nonconformities in one target area. So since 1995, the development that has taken place has not been house demolition and lot consolidation. We have had redevelopment in the area. We've had 5 new homes and 2 large additions, but these have occurred on individual lots. Three of the new homes were tear-down infill projects. And these next several slides here just kind of illustrate the homes that have been constructed or added on to since 95 and those that predate the 1995 zoning ordinance. These should have been included in your packets as well, so I'll just go through these quickly. And as I'm going through this, please feel free to stop me with any questions. You can see that there's a wide range of houses in this area. And the zoning ordinance does consider the impact that non-conforming lot status has on property owners. As you can see by those previous slides, they can be improved. They can be expanded or enlarged so long as the existing non-conformity is not increased. So if you have a substandard setback, let's say it's 5 feet, you can build along that line of the building with a setback of 5 feet. And it also even considers non-conforming properties that don't meet the lot area or lot frontage requirements conforming if you meet 80% of the requirement. So the real problem that we've had here is that of these 24 properties, there are 11 properties that do not meet even 80% of that lot area or lot frontage requirement. So they are unbuildable under our zoning regulations. And that means if the existing homes were destroyed by a tornado, they could not be rebuilt if the damage was more than 50% of the replacement value. Or if somebody wanted to purchase the property, tear it down, and rebuild with infill development, the lot would be unbuildable. So once the existing homes are removed, we're left with vacant properties. And this map here illustrates the 11 properties and the hatch marks here. These are the 11 properties that are considered unbuildable under the existing R1 zoning regulations. And you can see that they're really scattered out throughout this proposed amendment area. And that's important to note because I think one of the questions we're going to receive is if it's only 11 properties that are unbuildable, why are we proposing to rezone the entire area? And it's important to keep the continuity of the zoning district in terms of setbacks, lot coverages, and we're just trying to avoid spot zoning here, and that's why we're proposing the entire area. So part of the problem we have is for those properties that are unbuildable, owners are reluctant to invest in these properties because they're investing in a structure that could not be rebuilt if it was destroyed or removed. And likewise, banks are reluctant to loan on these properties because, again, the houses cannot be rebuilt or tear down and infill development is not possible. And as you could see in the earlier slides, there is reinvestment interest in the area that is being deterred for these reasons. So our proposed solution is to rezone all 24 properties to the R3 zoning district. The R3 district is a medium to high density single family district. The proposal would convert all but one of the properties to a buildable lot, a conforming lot. It's important to note that the one property that would not be buildable is a substandard lot, even in the highest density residential district. The R4 district is our highest density single family district, and this lot would not even be buildable under those regulations. So it's not that we're singling out one property or just ignoring a solution that works for all. In addition, it would eliminate almost half the non-conformities we've identified so far in terms of building setbacks, and it would provide some flexibility on what can be built on the properties. So this chart highlights the lot and area requirements for the R1, the existing R1 zoning on the left, and the proposed R3 zoning on the right. You can see the differences are in lot area, frontage, and setbacks, but the coverage and building height and FAR remains the same. And although it would allow for smaller lots with less frontage, it's important to note that this proposed change would not likely result in higher density in the area. We do have many of the properties now that do not conform with the existing R1 zoning, These properties have at least 200 feet of depth, and there's a requirement for frontage on First Street. Of the existing properties, there's only four that currently have enough frontage to be divided in the R3 district. And of those four properties, two of them have new homes on them, and the other two have substantial homes on them that there'd be some significant investment necessary to tear those down and replace them. And then in addition to that, we have extreme slopes on these properties. There's about 20-foot fall from First Street to the river. So any kind of stub street subdivision would be, again, a very significant investment in this area. This map will illustrate the properties that cannot be divided with their current lot frontages. Those are shown in the hash marks here. And then the underlying blue, I don't know if you can really make it out in this line here, it doesn't look like it. But there's underlying blue color in these properties here. These are properties that are unlikely to be demolished because they've had some investment put in them in the last several years or their new homes. So we're really talking about two properties that are left that could be divided if the zoning was passed tomorrow. And again, those two properties have homes on them, substantial size homes on them now. These properties are right now in the residential area 1, which means that the teardown infill regulations the city has adopted to apply. We're not proposing to change that designation. We want to make sure that any new infill houses or expansions in the area are compatible with the existing older homes in the area and also the recent infill houses. So we're not proposing to change the Area 1 designation. So just to summarize, we have the existing zoning was established in 1995, which created non-conforming properties to encourage lot consolidation. But over the past 14 years, we've had no lot consolidation. The type of redevelopment we've had has been on individual properties, and that 11 of the 24 properties are unbuildable under the current R1 zoning requirements. And that our proposal to rezone to the R3 district would convert all except one of the properties to a buildable lot. And then a summary of the process again is we're just requesting your authorization to look into this in more detail and discuss this with property owners to verify the information we have on our records, and then to ultimately move forward to the public hearing phase before the Planning Commission, and then come back before City Council. So, are there any questions?
Are there any questions for David? Alderman Flanagan.
I do have one. On the map, is the one that is not marked with a number, I guess, is that the one that's the property you're talking about regarding that it wouldn't be within the 24? If you go back to the map where you have all the numbers, yeah, that map. There's one up there that, there's one closer to St. Charles that doesn't have a number in it. Is that the lot that you're talking about?
Hold on 1 second here.
Between 817 and 827.
Yeah, 817 and 827.
I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers on this map.
Oh, okay. Well, it's the 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's five down. It's skinny.
It's, yeah, five down and... figured if you didn't...
Right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the substandard lot frontage
okay,
lots.
Okay, so that would be...
That would not be buildable.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Other questions from the Alderman? Oh, Alderman Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Singer. The only thing that might question that might come up in my mind is someone might ask, well, why couldn't each of these properties be reassigned the zoning which more correctly applies to it as it currently exists? Some of them would be R1, some R2, some R3, some R4. You referenced earlier that would be very close to spot zoning, which I understand is illegal.
Right, well, the intention of zoning districts is to create a neighborhood character, and we do that with regulations through setback requirements, lot coverages, lot frontage requirements, areas, which will give you orderly development throughout the area. So then that's really why we're proposing to rezone the entire strip here to the R3 district. And I mean, as we move forward, we're gonna be able to verify the information I found so far. But so many of these properties, at least 16 properties right now, do not comply with the R1 zoning requirements. And running through what zoning districts might be appropriate for these properties, I found that the R3 district was the one that really addressed the great majority of the non-conformities.
I think you've done a tremendous amount of work here, and it makes what you've said makes sense to me, but I think the important thing is getting the council's permission to go out and start discussing it with the homeowners, because I'm sure they will think of questions we don't, because they sit on the piece of property.
Correct.
And know the pluses and minuses of their particular piece. So the idea is your department is quite willing to sit down day or evening with any one of these homeowners.
Absolutely. I mean,
you'll send the letters out tomorrow, and then anyone who contacts you, you will one-on-one meeting at their convenience. Is that
right.
Correct?
We don't want to require them to meet with us, but we are more than happy to meet with them. And I think it would be beneficial for us to meet with them, because we can then verify what we have found in our records.
Thank you. I think you've done a tremendous amount of work. Mr. Singer, is it appropriate for me to now make a motion saying that the council authorizes the building the development department to contact these neighbors and suggest this proposed zoning change?
I certainly think it's within parameters. However, I think there may be other questions that need to be asked from the council members and possibly even from the audience. Are there any other council members interested in questioning David? Anyone from the audience?
Ron, I got one.
Alderman
Lamont. So, David, what is the downside for a guy who's on an R1 lot that doesn't need to change, who is currently conforming?
I mean, as you can see in the comparison table, all the regulations for the R3 district are less restrictive.
So he could still build what he has.
So we're not creating any nonconformities. We're actually expanding the area that he could put an addition on.
Right.
I think the only downside is you're going to have a fear factor of the density increasing in the area. You're going to say, well, you know, I like my large lot, and I'm afraid that we're going to have a lot
but
of subdivisions taking place.
That that's governed by the R1. So
no, it's, isn't it governed by the infill?
That's right. That's the R1.
Oh.
And the, oh, I'm sorry. Not the R1 low density, but the residential area number one is what I meant.
Okay. David, what kind of consensus would be necessary for you to carry this over into the Planning Commission?
What we'd like to do is meet with the property owners first to make sure that we have their feedback before moving forward. The city does have the right to propose a map amendment without the owner's consent, but then, of course, the owners do have the authority to object, legally object to,
yes,
to the proposal. So, but, I mean, if we get some feedback that that's going to be the case, I don't think that we'll pursue the request.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Are there any other questions? Alderman Brown, I think it's you may submit your proposal.
Yes, my motion is that we authorize the planning department to contact the residents of this area they have outlined tonight and discuss with them their proposal to change the existing zoning in this district from R1 to R3.
Okay, is there...
I'll second that, Mr. Mayor.
Actually, it's for a public hearing.
It's for a public hearing. For a public hearing. Yes, qualify that.
Yeah.
Include it. Yes.
Yes.
That's included in your motion.
And to have a public hearing if they think that that's appropriate based on the contact with the residents.
Very good. And Mr. Hill seconds that motion.
Yes, sir.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Let the record show that it was unanimous. Thank you, David. Well
done.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. Let us carry on to item C, to consider request of zoning ordinance text amendment to add catering services to permit use in LI Light Industrial District. James Gender, the chef, James Place Incorporated, is the applicant.
I'll make a motion to approve that.
Second.
Motion made by Hill, approved by Alderman Dantino. Any questions on the motion? Alderman Flanagan.
I just have a quick question on parking. It's adequate to have 15 parking spaces. From what I can understand, it would be 15 parking spaces, and are there enough parking spaces out there that qualify for that?
Yeah, staff has taken a comprehensive look at the entire building.
That's what I wanted to.
That's contemplated for this. This is just a text amendment, but,
right.
But we do have a location on Stephen Street where Mr. Gender intends to put this,
okay.
And the parking is adequate on the
okay.
site.
Yeah, because I want to make sure there was enough employee parking.
Yes.
Thank you.
Alderman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. I presume the definition of catering services prevents consumption of food on site.
That's that correct.
By the public.
That's correct. Restaurants are not allowed.
The chef can taste his soup to see if it's up to standard.
A chef can indeed taste his soup. Yes.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Anyone from the audience? Well, a motion has been made and it's been seconded. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Let the records indicate that is unanimous. We go now to item D, considering the amendment to Fisher Farm Plan Unit Development, deleting and amending language relating to building and parking regulations for commercial area C. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
So moved.
The request?
Second.
So moved. Second.
Alderman Marks sets the motion at hand, and Alderman Brown seconds the motion. Are there any questions? Alderman Flanagan.
I'm the question lady today. Regarding the overall footprint of the buildings, like from the conceptual look that we have in our packet and how we perceive that commercial entity to be in place, will the footprints of the building remain the same, and will that, or are there going to be different set of buildings totally if we pass this? And that's my first question. And then, will the parking remain in the front, or is it just going to be around the buildings?
Yeah, the nature of the, with respect to the building configuration, of the we actually have an approved site plan for the second half of the north site that's runs along the north side of Williamsburg. And that plan, is just it's approved, and it's really a function of when the property owner decides to proceed with the second building. The first building that was built on the property that I'm sure you're familiar with, there's a second building that's similar in its really the exact same building, but a little bit of a different orientation on the site. But basically, a second building is allowed there by the site plan approval that was approved, I think, a couple of years ago now. On the south side of the street, there's no specific development proposal that's been approved on that site. But under our text amendment here, what we're doing is we're changing the provision in the code that spoke to this concept of having the angled parking along Williamsburg a la West 8th Street and this more of a storefront type of building. So what would happen is that there would be setbacks required pretty much like any other conventional office type development.
It would go under the PUD?
That's correct. It would be part of the planning development. All of its amendatory material here is an amendment to the PUD.
Okay. And so that whole concept of the
goes away. Goes away.
What about the landscaping? Do we still have some?
Our minimum landscape requirements would all still be applicable to those sites.
I'm just concerned about those residents behind the building because one time they may have thought or...
Yeah, that's a good observation. What we've actually done with the current office building as it relates to the townhomes to the north, there's additional landscaping that's been added. There was a buffer planting on the townhome property. There was buffer landscaping that included in the office building that you see out there. There was also an opaque fence, a 6-foot fence that was installed along with the landscaping. So that there's quite a bit of attention that's been given to that that transition, and that same detail would be carried over with the second building on that north side of Williamsburg.
Okay. Thank you.
Alderman Gentino.
Well,
Dick, what was the thinking of retail in that location? I think that was probably prior to the comments coming in, but it looks like a tough spot for retail.
Well, that's been kind of the observation of staff. Certainly the marketplace has spoken volumes over, I don't know, 12 years, 13 years, whatever it's been. When the Fisher Farms Plan Unit Development was approved, there was really no commercial out there to speak of, right. and you know, Geneva Commons didn't exist, and a good portion of the retail to the south on Randall Road did not exist. And the thinking back then was this idea of creating this small cluster of convenience shops that would serve the residential population of Fisher Farms. Of course, we know what's happened with Randall Road since that was all done and thought of. What you have is some very basic retail gravity model kinds of things going on here, where the critical mass of retail that's been built along Randall Road has totally overwhelmed the retail potential of this site. The other thing that you know, hindsight's 20/20, but really a retail cluster at the intersection of Fisher Drive and Williamsburg with no sight lines to Randall Road really can't do much to pull retail activity into the site. And I really haven't done a market analysis, but I suspect that 750 dwelling units probably can't support that small cluster. You know, if you're talking about a 7-Eleven and a cleaners and, I don't know, shoe repair, whatever, and little convenience uses, chances of those being tucked away on that site with no sight lines to Randall Road being supported by that population, I think, are pretty slim. So, you know, we've, from the staff perspective and even from an economic development perspective, I know the Economic Development Department over the years has really looked at this site as perhaps a little bit on the marginal side, but hoping against hope that we could draw retail activity to the site. The simple fact is that the market has not responded and the market realities don't support retail at the site. That's not to say that retail couldn't be still done. We're lifting the restriction on the 10% office on the first floor, but we think it would likely go to office in the future.
Are there any other questions from the council members? Alderman Flanagan.
I don't have a comment. I just have a, I don't have a question. I have a comment. Yeah, that's how I think it was perceived when, because I sat on the council, that was one of the first very large developments that we worked on. And it was perceived that it would be a neighborhood kind of, you know, cleaners.
Yeah.
And Randall Road certainly took over, and, you know, I don't think it serves a purpose any longer, so I agree.
Any other questions? Any questions from the audience? Well, a motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion recorded. The vote was unanimous. Let us continue on. Item E. To consider the approval of certificate of acceptance for Allday Inc., that is the sanitary sewer and water main.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Vogelsberg, seconded by Alderman Vantino.
Pollock.
Alderman Pollock. Sorry, Mr. Alderman Pollock. Any questions on the issue?
I
think this is just a matter of housekeeping here.
No, this is just.
Those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Let it be recorded that the vote was unanimous. Let us go on to item F. Consider the approval of certificate of acceptance for Aldi Inc., that is the electrical improvements.
So moved.
Second.
Motion made by Vogelsberg, seconded by Alderman Marks. Any questions on this issue? Anyone from the audience? Oh, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Let it be recorded that the vote was unanimous. We go on now to item G. Consider bid award to Accurate Tank Technologies in the amount of $15,000 for the purchase and installation of fuel dispensers.
Move approval.
Second.
Motion made by Alderman Hill, seconded by Alderman Flanagan. Any questions on this issue? Anyone from the audience? Those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Let it be recorded that the vote was unanimous. As you know, item H has been removed from the agenda, will be brought forward at some future COW meeting. We are now in I. We are to consider the bid award for an annual purchase of primary cable. Necessary, see the exhibit B.
So moved,
Moved by Alderman Brown and seconded by Alderman Vogelsberg. Any question on this issue from the council members? Anyone from the audience? All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Let it be recorded that the vote was unanimous. We now move on down to item J. Consider the contract with dance party DJs in the amount not to exceed $5,000. I beg your pardon, $500 for a Cultural Arts Commission event.
I think the DJ put you typed up your agenda.
No.
Wow. I'm going to be a DJ.
Dancing with the Geneva Stars, that's going to be held on February the 6th in 2010.
Move approval.
Mr. Alderman Hill makes the motion. It's seconded by Alderman Mark. Any questions on this issue? Anyone from the audience? Those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? But the records indicate that the vote was unanimous. And we are now on item agenda K, to consider the approval of alley and certain parking space closures for Cultural Arts Commission event, Music in the Alleys, taking place on September 19, 2009.
So moved.
Second.
Motion made by Alderman Mark, seconded by Alderman Hill. Any questions on this issue? Anyone from the audience? Those in favor of the issue, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Let it be recorded that the vote was unanimous. We are now down to the items of new business. I do have a few items that I would like to bring forward to the council, but I will seek out anyone else from the council at this point in time. Anyone have any items dealing with new business? Okay. Well, I would like to remind you that the next city council meeting will be taking place on September 8th. That's due to the Labor Day holiday. So we are not meeting next week, Monday, which is the fifth Monday of the month. So you ladies and gentlemen have the evening off. So enjoy yourself.
Thank you very much.
I would like to... I'm sure you are all aware of Gary Black, who is retiring, who, as you know, has been the director of Tricon Central Dispatch for 33 years. And it was back in May of 2009 that Jerry was honored by the Association of Public Safety Communications Officials. He was awarded the Communications Center Director of the Year, which is quite a distinction and quite an honor. Jerry is a very dear friend of mine. He is a neighbor, one of my constituents. He's just a really, really fine man and been an honorable man and done such great things for the city. And beyond that, he's just a marvelous family man, too, as well. He's just really a delightful person. And they're honoring him the end of this month at a gathering at Riverside Receptions. I'm sure many of you have received an invitation. I hope some of you will be attending. I'll be there, and which really is of no significance, but I will be there.
Well, now we're going.
Yeah, now you all have to go.
It's the thing now.
Okay. I also would like you to be aware of the fact that the ethical leadership training will be held also on Tuesday, September the 8th, following the city council meeting. And I believe the police and fire commissioners will be there. The methods of the members of the city's ethics commission will be there, and also the sign committee members will be in attendance. So I think some of you have committed yourself to that evening, so please keep that in mind. Make sure that's placed on your calendar, and you'll see at that time. One other very important message I would like to have you been told of, that is on this coming Wednesday, is our Honorable Mayor Burns' birthday. So those of you here, as well as the citizens of Geneva, certainly cards would be nice, candy grams, flowers, whatever, you know, whatever is necessary. Wishing our Honorable Mayor a very healthy day and a hopefully a continuous day and continuous years as service to our city.
Perhaps you can give out his phone number, Ron.
That can't be found, I think, somewhere. I don't feel comfortable in
on the city website.
So, other than that, is there any other business to be discussed this evening?
Happy 50 to Kevin.
I'm sorry?
Happy 50 to Kevin.
I said the same thing, Ray, on this side. It's funny.
Yeah, you're always popular, Ray.
All right. Well, I think we are ready for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. Okay. Motion made by Alderman Hill, seconded by Alderman. I beg your pardon. Yes,
I just found out that Alderman Maladra celebrated his 50th birthday in July, and we never said happy birthday.
Well, what's the big deal about 50, Ray?
He's older than Kevin?
Okay, sorry.
Right. Well, happy birthday to you, Alderman Maladra. I hope you were treated well.
I was okay with it until we started with
and
the 50 thing.
Your wife took you out for pizza and beer?
A few. Attaboy.
All right, there was a motion.
I made a motion to adjourn.
A motion made to adjourn by Alderman Hill.
Right.
And seconded by Alderman Marks. Thank you. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Very good. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Good job, Ron.
Great job, Ron.
Nice job.
26. Yeah.
All right.
Very comforting. This year it was good that he was older than me.
Oh my gosh, it's like if doors open.
Oh yeah.
I think you're the one.
Really?
11. Correct?
Nationwide. Huh?
Thank you. Yeah, I wish I was 50.
Yeah, any moment you'll hear about it.
Yeah, I don't think I get that presence, but it is that teacher.